Welcome to the SPE Podcast, powered by the Society of Petroleum Engineers. You're listening to SPE Live, hydrogen as part of the energy mix, commercial and technical perspectives. The audio from this episode was previously recorded on March 20th, 2024. And now your moderator, Zachary Evans.
Welcome to this SPE Live, hydrogen as part of the energy mix, commercial and technical perspectives. My name is Zachary Evans, and I'm the sales director of underground storage for Dark Vision. Today's SPE Live will last 30 minutes, and we encourage you to ask questions throughout the event. And it's now my pleasure to introduce our guests. First, Thomas Major is a managing partner of MB Energy Partners, a private equity firm investing in companies who supply products and services to the energy transition. Thomas is also a partner with Tupper Lake Partners, a venture capital firm investing in early stage energy-focused technology startups. Prior to his time at MB Energy and Tupper Lake, Thomas spent most of his career with NOV in various roles in engineering, operations, and corporate development, focused on both oil field services and renewable energy. Our second speaker is Pedram Finalu, is DNV's director for the low carbon segment for North America, where he supports customers in their decarbonization plans and de-risking investments. Pedram applies his two decades of experience in the energy industry and supports the deployment of services covering clean hydrogen, ammonia, carbon capture and storage, and low carbon fuels. As a segment director, Pedram assists DNV's customers in addressing some of the most complex issues facing the energy industry, including strategic, technological, and policy decisions needed to navigate the energy transition successfully. He also coordinates DNV's go-to-market strategy. Thomas and Pedram, welcome to SPE Live.
Thank you, Zachary. Nice to be here.
Well, we certainly appreciate your all's time this morning. We look forward to your expertise in this discussion. Obviously, hydrogen is a very hot topic, not just within our own SPE landscape, but also the world in general. But before we get started with some specific questions, maybe we can just kind of set the stage, get both of your thoughts on, you know, where the hydrogen economy kind of sits right now. What the state is concerning both, you know, where we are, where we want to be. Just your kind of opening thoughts. Maybe Thomas, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a pretty loaded opening question.
It certainly is.
When I think about the hydrogen, at least the end market for hydrogen, I sort of think about it in two pieces. So there's a very large existing market, which is primarily used in refining and production of ammonia. You know, that's a market that is over 100 billion in size worldwide. It's been around a long time, primarily traditional steam methane reform types of processes and really well established supply chains, technology and uses for it. And really, you know, I would consider that sort of hydrogen as a chemical input, as a chemical building block. And then the second market, so that market, I would say, is just steady as she goes. It's a mature, longstanding, existing market that has a really well-defined demand and supply chain. The newer markets, which is what garners a lot more of the attention, is, you know, things like hydrogen for use in transportation, energy storage, other industrial point sources, really is a big part of the decarbonization story. You know, that has been a little bit more of an up and down story in terms of the journey that hydrogen has gone on. That's what I would call sort of the new hydrogen economy that a lot of people refer to. And you know, it's much higher risk, kind of higher reward. The last couple of years have been tough. Interest rates has been tough for that as well. A lot of chicken and egg problems in terms of, you know, is the demand and uses for hydrogen there, and then finding ways to produce it at lower cost with lower carbon. So, we can talk about both of those markets today. Happy to dive into either of them and the role that the oil field and oil and gas industry could play in them.
Mm-hmm. Pedram, turning to you.
Yeah, I agree with Thomas on those points. Maybe I'll tack on a few more kind of niche areas. So, you know, we see that with the International Maritime Organization's decarbonization goals by 2050, which is a phased approach to reducing emissions from shipping, that there's a lot of interest in clean methanol. And you have players like Maersk who are developing like global supply chains so that, you know, their vessels have access to clean methanol around the world. Another big area of interest is North America becoming an exporter of hydrogen, and you know, through the same kind of ammonia production pathways, using that as a carrier to get hydrogen to other parts of the world, like Europe and Southeast Asia, who are already paying premiums for energy and can maybe absorb the cost of clean hydrogen. And then we also see, you know, interplay between CCUS and hydrogen and the ethanol industry to be a candidate for sustainable aviation fuels in North America. So there's lots of things going on. Lots of people trying to figure out how to build a business in these areas, and they're coming up against some issues of uncertainties around things like the IRA. Financing is also a big consideration. So a lot of activity, but again, I agree with Thomas, it's a bit of a chicken and egg kind of scenario, because you know, you need an off-taker to be a partner for the long term to really make these deals fly.
No, great points to kind of set the stage, as you mentioned. I appreciate the kind of bifurcating the markets into the existing role. And I think that's something that a lot of people forget about, is that while hydrogen is very popular today in terms of, you know, base fuel usage as a potential future kind of energy source, we've been using hydrogen for hundreds of years in other, you know, industrial purposes. So I appreciate you outlining that. And obviously there is a lot of uncertainty going forward in anything, let alone this hydrogen and this emerging kind of energy transition market. So as we talk a little bit more about, you know, focusing on, you know, the dollars of this, you know, I mean, any kind of adoption large scale really leans back on, you know, cost and competitiveness of the projects themselves. So from an investor's perspective, both from your own, you know, Thomas, in your case, you know, as an investor or as Pedram, as someone who helps get people ready to the investment round, I mean, what are the challenges there when it comes to current costs of hydrogen projects and maybe competitiveness against other project ROIs?
Yeah. And again, you probably have to look at this in the two different market segments. You know, when you're talking about, you know, just installing another steam methane reform unit at a refinery, that's pretty straightforward. You know, that's investable. And as investors, we always think about things really in two major terms. It's the amount of risk you're taking by putting money into something, and then how big the reward is. So usually lower risk is lower reward, but in higher risk, you'd expect a higher reward. And so the existing markets, I'd say that's sort of like your low risk, low reward type of markets. The new markets, that's higher risk, higher reward. But you're also, so in the existing markets, the chemical markets, they need hydrogen. In the new markets, there are alternative fuels you're trying to displace. So you have a different bar that you're trying to meet, you have different substitutes that you're trying to compete against. So in things like transportation or even maritime applications, you're trying to compete against fossil fuel, things like diesel at the end use. And the idea being that hydrogen can be a decarbonized option. But it is much, much more expensive. So, I mean, we're talking about multiples more expensive still than liquid hydrocarbons. So that as much as they're continuing, in fact, based off of some of my back of the napkin calculations, a lot of applications, you'd be better off from an economic standpoint continuing to burn diesel and offset it with direct air capture, as opposed to using a fully decarbonized hydrogen source after you add all of the costs to decarbonizing it and then actually getting it to fueling, you know, your truck or what have you. So those markets continue to be very challenged because, you know, there's just an ecosystem that doesn't exist yet. You know, it's going to continue, I think, to take a lot of stimulus from the government to be able to bring that ecosystem together. So that's something that I would call the higher risk, higher reward. But if you look at it just from a returns perspective, at least in the recent history, share prices of the big players here have dropped by sort of, you know, call it 90-95% over the last couple of years as liquidity has dried up in the market. So it's a very difficult story right now in a lot of those new hydrogen markets, where the risk is quite high, but the reward is still kind of questionable whether that jives with the risk that's being taken. But you know, there's still opportunities. I mean, you've got to find a way to get the cost of carbon capture for using blue hydrogen down, or the cost of electrolysis and the renewable energy for using green hydrogen down. significantly to be able to compete with regular fossil fuels. And also the cost of transporting it, the cost of storing it, the entire supply chain. So there's a lot of room for continued innovation, both in business models as well as in technology.
And Pedram, do you have any other thoughts to add on the challenges of the cost and competitiveness?
Yeah, and just to put that into context, you know, when we talk about hydrogen, we talk about kilograms. Whereas when we talk about natural gas, we talk about BTUs. So just to talk about the competitiveness, and if we converted the DOE's moonshot or hydrogen shot again to a dollar per kilogram of hydrogen, that translates to about $8 per million BTU, in thermal units. And when natural gas is trading at less than three, what we're trying to do is get people to voluntarily opt for a higher cost fuel. Now, it's really costing about $5 or $6 per kilogram. So the differential is giant. And when a lot of fuels are, indexed to electricity price indexed to, price of fossil fuels, you start to see, what's the problem here. We're trying to get end users to find a way to use a fuel. And there's only been one law in energy in all of human history, which is the cheapest fuel always wins. that being said, you could see the scale of the challenge here. So, people have to look very carefully about what's the value proposition, what's the need of the off-taker, and there are isolated areas where you could make money. I've heard, investors say that actually the investments in hydrogen refueling stations in California can be profitable because of the LCFS standard there. But again, it's just Thomas said, without policy and government support for a lot of these projects, it's hard to make the long-term economics work out.
No, it makes a lot of sense. In my own professional career, having worked on some hydrogen feasibility studies for underground storage, we always use the rule of thumb of about three times as much hydrogen by volume to match the same BTU, just in terms of a storage and transport side of things. So, clearly that scaling is there. And you mentioned, both of you touched on this, in terms of not just challenges, but opportunities for increased innovation and development of new technologies. So maybe kind of shifting, understanding the challenges currently with some potential hydrogen projects. Where do you guys see both the need and the current trend as far as, maybe technological advancements or innovations that are necessary to really get the cost competitiveness down, even notwithstanding policy change?
Yeah, and just going back to ammonia, I think ammonia is a very feasible pathway. I mean, there's over two dozen clean ammonia projects going on right now in North America. Several of them are already under construction. And Thomas said, there's a ready made market globally for fertilizers that you could take advantage of. And then you could leverage that in the future to use it as a carrier for hydrogen to other foreign markets. Technology-wise, if we think about blue pathways, carbon capture and storage, industry more or less knows how to do that. There might be some issues and delays in permitting, for like Class 6 wells and things like that. So it's not easy, but it's doable. Green pathways, electrolyzer technology is improving. They're scaling up. The balance of plant kind of questions, you start seeing that actually electrolyzer manufacturers are integrating more of the power electronics and utilities into the packages to make it easier to install and get up and running and increase the efficiencies. But we're at like the 10, 20, 30, 50 megawatt kind of scale. And really what we need to get to is like gigawatt scale. So we're a little ways away from getting there. So that's where some development still need to happen. And that's probably why it's probably going to be the 2030s before, green hydrogen takes over from blue hydrogen as those cost curves come down and the scale goes up.
And just for the, Thomas, before we get your comments, just as a reminder to our audience, there is, you know, the rainbow of hydrogen, which, you know, we use kind of ubiquitously at this point. Green hydrogen, obviously being hydrogen sourced from excess renewable energy, blue hydrogen being fossil fuel based hydrogen paired with a carbon capture. So just for the audience's benefit there. But Thomas, your thoughts on technology and innovation and where things need to head.
Yeah, so I think, you know, on the blue hydrogen front, it really is, it's a question of carbon capture, right? We know how to produce that hydrogen, but it's the carbon that comes off. And there's two sources of CO2 emissions. So one is the direct CO2 emission from the reforming process, and then the other is from the flue gas, because it takes a lot of heat to do it too. Mm. You know, the reformed hydrogen is a higher CO2, the CO2 coming off that is higher concentration CO2. So it's a bit more cost effective. Flue gas is a little harder because that's more sort of a burned type of flue gas mixture with a lower CO2 concentration in it. But in any event, the current, at least in the U.S., you're really trying to make those numbers work with the 45Q tax credit in $85. You know, you've got to have a lot of things fall into place. You got to be in the right geographic location, perhaps most importantly, to be able to make that work with current sort of aiming carbon capture technologies. You know, you've got to be somewhere either with really close access to a CO2 pipeline or, with really close access to some sort of disposal well or both. You know, the $85 still doesn't put a ton of CCS projects into the money. So, you know, that's lower cost, like some sort of alternative to amine, I think is an area that has a big opportunity from a CCS standpoint, which impacts all carbon capture projects, but directly impacts blue hydrogen. On the green hydrogen side, I think that Pedro was hit the nail on the head. You know, it's electrolyzer technology. You know, the challenge there is that the technologies keep getting better, efficiencies keep getting better, which is also important, not just the capital cost, but also the conversion efficiency, because the conversion cost to all of these processes. You know, I think that's something we all know, that technology is improving, it's going to keep getting better. The thing that has to happen for big projects to start happening in larger scale is that we need to start settling on a technology. Everybody's afraid to sort of bet on a tech. It's sort of like, you know, buying an EV 10 years ago, you're afraid to do it because you knew technology was changing so fast. You wanted to wait a few more years because you knew that car was going to be way better than whatever you're buying now and probably cheaper. It's sort of the same place right now for hydrogen. So to install a green hydrogen project, the incentives have to be really, really compelling to do it now. Because otherwise, you know, with interest rates are probably going to come down too. So this is another factor that is from an investment standpoint, there's a lot of reasons just to wait. You know, I'm not sure if just technology is going to solve that, because that becomes a much more multifaceted, sort of challenge, in terms of how to accelerate those. You know, the 45V could help open up some of that. But even so, like renewable energy, which is what is a prerequisite for the 45V, that costs 50% more for a new project than it did at near zero interest rates. So even your fuel source, the electricity source, is much more expensive. So there's a lot of reasons economically and sort of from a risk management standpoint to just wait right now on green hydrogen projects. So I would say in the interim, continue to accelerate the iterations of innovation in electrolyzers is what's going to help us get to the promised land faster.
And, yep, go ahead, Pedro.
Sorry, I was going to add to the technology issues. Maybe I undersold like the CCS type issues, and something Thomas said remind me about this. So when we talk about CCS, and we said, you know, we've done carbon capture and enhanced oil recovery before, that's true. I think what people need to realize that impurities in CO2 streams make a big difference to integrity of those systems. So there's still material technology being developed, operations that need to be devised for CO2 systems. So, you know, one reason why ammonia production and blue ammonia is taking off is that the carbon capture from that can be effective. And the CO2 stream is, you know, relatively pure. So it's easier to design a system around that. When we get to hard to abate sectors like cement and, you know, other industries, where there's actually a much higher chance of getting impurities in the CO2 stream, that could have significant effects on the pipeline and the storage well, negative effects. So that's why, you know, these blue production pathways make sense in a few places, like ammonia and ethanol production, because you get a relatively pure CO2 stream. But when you start going outside of that, and when people start thinking about, you know, I'll develop a point-to-point carbon capture hub, but then I'll invite, you know, other high CO2 emitters to tie into that. Those other two, you know, high CO2 emitters can start introducing impurities into that stream that can basically end up undermining the whole system. So that's where some of the challenge still lies technology-wise on blue production pathways. It's expanding that to encompass more industries that maybe don't have the controls on impurity management in the CO2 streams.
No, that's a great point. I think that's often lost on a lot of folks, that the efficiency both of the process flow capture and the purity of the CO2 stream with an ethanol plant, for example, is much different than some of the other applications. And Thomas, I also appreciate, you know, your comment regarding the geography part of this. You know, it's a supply and demand market in terms of energy, and this is no different. So there's a lot of complications there. So great commentary so far. I do want to remind our viewers that if you'd like to ask a question, please make sure to type that in the chat. And if we have time, our guests will answer that either here or after the fact. Just kind of, you know, as we're getting closer to the end of the discussion, one thing I did kind of want to circle back to, and Thomas, you had mentioned this before, is, you know, for most of our audience is in the oil and gas space traditionally. We know that there's a lot to be learned from the industrial and refining, especially along the U.S. Gulf Coast, in terms of hydrogen. You know, what kind of experience can we farm? What kind of lessons can we learn? And where is that overlap between, you know, the traditional oil field, not just from a staffing and technology kind of, but also in terms of our investment mindset and the things that we've been successful building out in the past. So curious to your all's thoughts there about how we can overlap, you know, our current audience with this emerging energy tech.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing that jumps off to the page to me is that the oil and gas industry is really well positioned to lead the charge in CCS development and CCS projects and implementation. It's most of that's going to be subsurface storage, and the oil and gas industry is the industry that understands that and also has oil and gas is providing a lot of the funding for technologies that are going to improve the CO2 capture as well. So, you know, the oil field has been dealing with CO2 almost since its inception. So very familiar with how to manage it. There's room for improvement there, even though it's a well understood way that we have to innovate to get the cost down. But when I think of what really jumps off the page, that's it. Obviously, once you produce hydrogen, the infrastructure to move it around is something that the oil and gas industry has some ability to bring to bear. But I think that's going to be sort of a bit more niche, kind of bespoke applications. I'm not sure if you're going to see a huge infrastructure blast and pipelines crisscrossing the country very soon. I think the oil and gas industry has a lot more to bring from the carbon capture side on blue hydrogen.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Adrian, any thoughts in on that topic?
Let's just say a couple of things. Like energy transition is about convergence. So it's not going to just be one industry. So, you know, oil and gas doesn't have all the answers, and you know, neither do renewables. So really what we're seeing more and more is there's an integration of these different kind of competence areas where, you know, renewable power is still important, even if you're making, you know, blue ammonia, which is, you know, one of the things ExxonMobil is getting to grips with right now with their project on the Gulf Coast. So I think, you know, I mean, one of the reasons why I have this job in DNV is because of my oil and gas background, because understanding how we manage and move molecules and utilize them is really important. And it's very difficult to look at molecule-based systems in a segmented kind of approach where each part of the value chain is siloed. You know, you need to look at the full heat and material balance for a plant to really understand, does it work or does it not work? Where are the bottlenecks? You know, oil and gas competence is still really important and will be important in the future in energy transition. So that's maybe what I could offer to folks. And that will come to fruition in lots of ways. When I meet customers who are looking into hydrogen or any other kind of derivative fuel, most of the time it's people who've had some kind of oil and gas background. And investors, when they're deciding if they're going to make investment or finance any kind of M&A activity, they want to know that there's the right people with experience in those technologies to actually make the project work. It's not going to go away. It just needs to be adapted, and we just need to realize that the energy transition is going to be about integrating this with other developments in whether it's renewables or other spaces.
And kind of dovetailing into that kind of perfectly, we do have a question from over on the SPE Energy stream. And that question is, what are we doing to attract college students and young professionals to hydrogen operations? And it kind of goes hand in hand with what you're saying, Pedram, about utilizing that same skill set, maybe just in a different capacity. So any of your thoughts on, you know, the kind of the opportunities for younger professionals in this emerging market?
I mean, if you're willing to adapt your, excuse me, your knowledge to the energy transition, I mean, I think it's still a great industry to be part of. I mean, the oil and gas industry has had its downturn, you know, the shale revolution, and then, you know, COVID came along. You know, we're trying to accomplish something in one generation, which is to create a decarbonized energy system that took us five generations to get here. So we're going to need a lot of smart people who are going to be dedicated towards this. Just as Thomas said, you know, innovate. Energy industry has always found a way to innovate itself out of a corner, you know, through generations of regulations that come into place. This one's harder because we're trying to do it in one generation. But I think all the young people that we can get can contribute to it.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to that. You know, the question is, I guess, what are we doing to attract? My simple answer is I'm not really sure. But when I think about young people who might have some interest in the space, you know, there's a lot of different skill sets that have to come together. But at the core of it, it's really sort of like a chemical and process engineering problem. And you know, I don't know if it's necessarily a hydrogen specific skill you need to have, because this is going to be just a piece of a much larger puzzle that's going to be part of the energy mix moving forward. So I think that having it in your tool belt to be able to understand what's going on in hydrogen operations is very valuable. But you know, hydrogen is an incredibly flexible and valuable chemical feedstock, and it has some interesting potential applications in energy and uses as well. But it comes down to understanding chemical processes, and so you know, I would say that's sort of the skill that needs to be recruited to be able to continue to move a lot of these projects forward, certainly from an execution standpoint.
That makes a lot of sense. And gentlemen, I appreciate both of your comments so far. I think this has been a very enlightening discussion on a topic that is, you know, very much on the forefront of a lot of people's minds. As we close out here, any final comments for our audience, you know, regarding hydrogen as a general concept? Thomas, maybe we'll start with you.
These open-ended questions, they're difficult. I think that I don't have a whole lot of additional comments other than, you know, there's a lot of work to be done here. So, you know, find I mean, it doesn't have to be all hydrogen, right? If it's an area of interest, find a corner of the hydrogen landscape and build expertise in it and see what you can do to contribute in that. I don't think that there's no silver bullet here. So what we need is going to be experts in subsegments of this. So that would probably be my closing comment.
Yeah, and I like what Thomas said because he tees up some of my catchphrases I like, which is, I agree, there's no silver bullets, but we need to think about silver buckshot. and that's all the energy transition is going to take. It's there's no panacea kind of solution. We do need to think about things more flexibly, and we've got to start somewhere. So I hope we're at the bottom beginning end of an S curve as we start to see some things like the hydrogen hubs start to be implemented and we start getting value chains put together and the supply chain put together that will start to snowball and by the time we get to the end of this decade hopefully we'll have this same kind of conversation with. A lot of investments in Thomas's portfolio and a lot of completed projects in DNV's portfolio. But I think the future is bright. I know we have challenges with regulations and understanding incentives, although those will be resolved. And I think as deeper we go into energy transition, the public will come to realize that they'll support this more and see the benefits of it, once it starts moving into their communities and creating jobs. So I'm an optimist. That's how I think of the future. And let's see what happens.
Yeah, as you said, it's an exciting time. A lot of opportunities, a lot of challenges, as you both laid out. But that challenges just allow a lot of opportunities for innovation and new engagement. And as Thomas, you mentioned, a lot of work to be done. And then we certainly appreciate y'all's role in that. And we certainly welcome those watching today to get involved if this is an area that they are particularly passionate about. Gentlemen, thanks both of you for your time this morning. Apologies for the open-ended questions, but I really appreciate the discussion. Very practical information, and I'm sure our audience appreciates it too. Thank you for your questions and comments, and thanks to our audience for joining us today. And a reminder, we'll see you here next time on SPE Live.
Thanks for listening to the SPE Live podcast. For more content, visit the SPE Energy Stream, the industry's digital pulse, at streaming.spe.org. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and review. Join us next time on the SPE Live podcast.